Now, we were speaking last time about chapter 2, the setting of the prophecy. We noticed that there is no reason to think that it had been was just an arbitrary action on Nebuchadnezzar's part. I think we are quite justified in concluding that he had been fooled by these so-called wise men, and therefore he said, "This is decision is firm from me." Now the word only occurs in this chapter, and so the way that it was guessed at before the word has gone out from me could just as well mean exactly the same thing. This is the word that I have given. In fact, that word is often used for a command. But the way it's stated in the King James Version in two different verses, it could suggest that he meant he had forgotten it. I don't believe there is any necessity of taking it as he'd forgotten it, even if the word meant it has gone out from me. Could mean the command has gone out. But it is quite generally recognized, as I mentioned to you last time, that in at least one of these places, the word is the word which means firm. Now, I just received a question as to whether that's so in both the cases, but unfortunately, I didn't bring my Aramaic with me this morning, so I'll look that up later. But it's my impression it's the same in both of them. Now, we also we began to look at Nebuchadnezzar's vision. And we noticed Nebuchadnezzar was king from 605 to 562, and his vision has two parts. First, there is a static picture, a statue with three parts. Then we notice that it has a dynamic series of events. And I asked you to look at those events for the assignment for today. We will not immediately get to the discussion of them, but I hope I can get to that before the end of the hour. Capital C, the interpretation, under that number one is the meaning of the statue. And there I think it is important that we have in mind that if God gave a person a dream, and the dream showed a statue in front of you, which was made up of five different kinds of material, that you would have no basis whatever to make any guess as to what this meant. Some people have suggested that this statue was the basis for the statue described in the next chapter that Nebuchadnezzar put up in the plain of Dura and told everybody to worship. Now that's purely a guess. We have no reason to say it relates to it. But you would have no basis to have any idea of what this statue meant. That it meant a progression of events from the head down to the feet, it might just as well mean a progression of events from the feet up to the head. Or it might mean a situation that was present at that time. It might represent various nations of that particular time, or various types of people, various languages. It might represent something about mining, or general plans for the advance of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. There would be absolutely no way to have any idea what the statue meant, except as you have the interpretation given. And when you have the interpretation given to it, we could immediately begin, after we know that it represents a series of events, starting with the head and moving down to the foot. Then we could, if we were inclined, to make guesses as to what each part meant. For instance, he said to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are this head of gold." Well, does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar, being the head, had better eyesight than anybody else in his kingdom because the statue had eyes of gold? Does it mean he had better hearing than anybody else in the kingdom? Does it mean he had a better mind than any ruler who would ever come? Does it mean that he could hear better? There are all kinds of guesses we could make from parts of the statue. But that would be purely guesswork. We have no reason to say it is divine teaching. Now we move down a little further in the statue, and we find that the breast and arms are made of bronze. The Old English says brass. And That is unfortunate. The Hebrew word is simply copper. It can stand for any alloy of copper. And it could be brass, which we think of as a rather shiny and not particularly strong thing. But the common alloy of copper in ancient times was bronze, which was very strong and was widely used for weapons. And, yes? We're not to the bronze yet. Thank you. What I said will apply to the next part. But the breast and arms are of silver. And as you look at the breast and arms, you have three parts. You have two arms, and I suppose the hands would be included. We can't say where the hands are included or whether the hands belong with the next part down. What do the fingers mean? What does it mean that there is a central body and two arms? Are there going to be three parts to the next kingdom? There are all kinds of guesses we could make, but we have no basis for them unless we're specifically told something about them in Scripture. Then the third part, which is of bronze, thank you for calling our attention to that, and of bronze is a better translation, unless you want to say copper, which would be equally good, than brass, as it is in the King James. Brass is stronger than silver. And perhaps silver is a slightly better conductor of electricity than bronze. But I don't think either of those facts tells us anything about the meaning of the statue. Now we notice that the third part includes the belly and the thighs. That would mean that it would reach from about the middle of the trunk down about to the knees. Does that mean that the third kingdom is going to be originally one and then divided into two parts? We have no basis in the account to lead us to think so. Then we have the legs, which are of iron. And it's quite generally thought that the legs stand for the Roman Empire. And some people say that the fact that there are two legs indicates the eastern and western parts of the Roman Empire. I don't think we have any more warrant for that than for the previous statements, particularly as we realize that the Roman Empire lasted for 4 centuries and was almost ready for its downfall before its division into two parts occurred. And so I just want to warn against that sort of reading into it additional meanings beyond what is suggested in the text. Now, we may, as we find other parallels somewhere, have a right to look back and say, here is something that fits with something in the history or that fits with something in a later prediction. But at this point, I'm particularly anxious that we look at it from the viewpoint of what do we have in this chapter. We think of Nebuchadnezzar and of Daniel, and what would they find there? Now, we may find points suggested which are clarified later in Daniel or in the New Testament. And in such a case, if you have a note, particular things like that, you might make a note of them and bring them to attention later. Make a note of anything that occurs to you where you think something later in the Bible throws light on something here. But at this point, we're interested in seeing what we have here and what can legitimately be drawn from this without looking further forward in the Scripture. We are justified, I think, at this point in looking at the future history to see how it fits with it. Now then, number two, the parts of the statue in general. What has specific meaning and what is only part of the picture? That I was just speaking of. B, what do the metals signify? Well, we are told, you are this head of gold. But beyond that the head of gold stands for Nebuchadnezzar, I don't think we have a right to say that it means that the Babylonian kingdom had more gold than any of the other later kingdoms, or that it was a more powerful kingdom, that it was a greater kingdom. It is simply the first of the metals. It doesn't say anything about a difference in meaning between the gold and the silver. Silver next, and then the bronze, and then the iron. Now the iron, we do have evidence that it has a specific meaning. It says that as iron is strong and breaks everything, similarly this kingdom will be strong. So we have four kingdoms here mentioned, and of which the fourth one is to be very strong. And of course, the art of warfare was gradually improved through those years. The Persians, for instance, were able to make tremendous conquests because of their ability with shooting arrows. And they would shoot great clouds of arrows, and nothing could stand before them. But then the Greeks came under Alexander the Great, and they were encased in heavy armor and standing close together with this strong armor that could hold back the arrows, that could keep them from injuring them. And they had a step forward. And each, the art of war stepped forward, so we might say that the iron represents a stronger force than any previous one. Now, how much beyond that it goes, we don't know, but we do know that the iron stands for strength. And then there is clay mixed with iron in the feet and toes, and the clay, we are told more about what it indicates. We look at that later. Number D, the five parts of the statue. The five parts of the statue. As it is stated, I just referred to four kingdoms. As it is stated here, you could not tell whether there were four kingdoms or five kingdoms. I have not noticed anything here that would indicate which. There are five parts. The fourth and fifth have a similarity that one of them is entirely iron, the other is partly iron. Are they the same kingdom, or are they two distinct kingdoms? I don't think you can decide that from chapter 2, unless someone eventually calls my attention to some point I haven't noticed there. But I do think that point can be definitely decided when we get to chapter 7. So for the present, I think we should say that we do not know whether there are four kingdoms or five. There are definitely five parts. Now, number one, the starting point is Nebuchadnezzar. And we have a remarkable series of statements that Daniel makes to Nebuchadnezzar in verse 36 to 37. I'd like to read those as they stand in the King James Version. Daniel said, this is the interpretation. We'll tell its interpretation before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven has he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar had a power that none of us have to order the birds of the heaven, which direction they're to fly, and to tell them to change their migratory progress as we may choose? It sounds to me like flattery given to Nebuchadnezzar. God has given the fowls of the heaven into his hand and made him ruler over them all. I'm sure that the birds could fly over Babylonia, and there'd be very little that Nebuchadnezzar could do about it, unless they flew rather low. And there are many beasts of the field that he could not possibly control. Thou art this head of gold. I asked a question there. Are Daniel's words to Nebuchadnezzar inerrant? I believe very definitely in the inerrancy of Scripture, that whatever God has given us in the Scripture about any subject, we can stand upon and accept and believe that it is true. But I think we have to be very careful in it. When Daniel gives Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation that God has given to Daniel, we can certainly accept every word that he says as being absolutely true and without error. But when he flatters Nebuchadnezzar a little bit, as he begins to tell him what this means, I would question just how far we can go in saying that that is a true description of Nebuchadnezzar's power. Wherever the children of men dwell, were there no Indians in the United States at that time? Were there no great civilizations in Mexico or in Peru at that time? Were there no peoples in China at that time, we have very considerable evidence that there were great numbers of people in these areas, some of them possessing rather high civilization, and none of them ever having heard, probably, of Nebuchadnezzar. I say probably because it's most likely there was commercial traffic between Babylon and Egypt and China at this time. But these introductory words, the statement that is made, that is part of the interpretation, is, "Thou art this head of gold." The head of gold stands for you. But the flattering word that he gives to Nebuchadnezzar, it is absolutely true that that is what Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar. But that Daniel's words represent exact truth, I think, would be carrying inerrancy beyond what it means. Well, now, number two, here's an interesting question. What is meant by this head of gold? Is this Nebuchadnezzar? Is he the head of gold? Immediately when you mention that, you can turn to these pieces of paper that I have given you here, and we have a few facts on them. I'm not giving this to you to memorize. There may be some of it you will think important to remember, but there are facts on it that will be useful in connection with today's lecture and with many subsequent lectures during the course. So please keep this sheet and have it with you when we want to refer to it. Now you notice I mentioned the Neo-Babylonian Empire. There had been a great power from Babylon many centuries before Nebuchadnezzar, which had wielded control over a very large area. And then that had been overcome by the Assyrians, who followed the Babylonian culture very closely, so closely that we can think of them as one civilization, the Assyrian and the Babylonian. And for some centuries, Babylon was subject to Assyria, with its capitals first at Ashur and then at Nineveh. And during those centuries, Babylon was constantly trying to get its independence. But there was a close similarity of culture, of type of people, and of language between the two. Eventually, the Babylonians gained their independence, as I've mentioned here, overthrow of the Assyrian army by forces of Nebuchadnezzar and of the Medes. Now, whether I should have said of Nebuchadnezzar, I'm not quite sure there, because in 604 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar was a great force. In 614, the other date I've given here, it was probably his father. His father had been governor of Babylon and Babylonia under the Assyrians, and he had revolted. And then a group of peoples to the east of them, who were called the Medes, who had a rather loose confederacy of these different tribes, joined together with the father of Nebuchadnezzar. And in 614, they destroyed the old capital of Assyria at Ashur. 2 years later, they were able to conquer Nineveh, which had been its capital for some centuries, and to destroy it in 612. They destroyed it so completely that until 150 years ago, no one even knew where Nineveh had been, one of the great cities of ancient times. But a large group of the Assyrians fought on after that, and it wasn't until 604 when Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar, was leading the army. In fact, a year after Nabopolassar died, that Nebuchadnezzar and the Medes together put a complete end to the Assyrian force. And some of the Assyrian territory was taken over by the Medes, but the greater part of the territory was taken over by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar reigned from 605 to 562. He was unquestionably one of the great fighters of ancient times, one of the great rulers. He deserves all the prominence that he is given. "Thou, O Nebuchadnezzar, art this head of gold." But then it says in verse 39, "After thee shall arise another kingdom, another third kingdom of bronze, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron." Well, when Nebuchadnezzar died in 562, he was succeeded by his son, Amel-Marduk, who reigned for 2 years. but proved not to be a very satisfactory ruler, so he was assassinated, and a general who had married a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, Nergal-Sharezer, I think there's a misspelling here, does it say Sharezer or Sharezer? It should be Sharezer, succeeded him. His name is sometimes shortened into Nergal-Sharezer. And he ruled 4 years and then was succeeded by his son, who was very unsatisfactory and was soon removed. And then a man named Nabonidus became king. Now, does this mean that the breast and arms represent Amil-Marduk, who reigned 2 years, and that the belly and thigh represents Nergal-Sharezer? Certainly, neither Labashi-Marduk nor Nabonidus would be worthy to represent as the great force of iron. So we must say that when it says, you are the head, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold, and after you will arise another kingdom, we must say that this is either jumping ahead, there's a gap there between Nebuchadnezzar's death and the coming of this other kingdom, some years later, in 539, about 23 years later, or else that when you say, thou art this head of gold, it represents not simply Nebuchadnezzar, but the empire of which he is the temporary head. And so, as between those two, I incline to think that the second is the more likely interpretation. That this does not represent Nebuchadnezzar alone, but represents the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But then again, we get a question. The Neo-Babylonian Empire altogether only lasted from 605 to 539. The Persian Empire lasted 2 centuries. The Hellenistic Empire lasted about 2 centuries, and the Roman Empire lasted for somewhere between 4 and 6 centuries. When you say, thou art this head of gold, does it mean just the Neo-Babylonian kingdom? Or is it the entire period, perhaps, of a Assyro-Babylonian imperial power? A period of about nearly 1,000 years in which great power was wielded by the Babylonians and the Syrians, and again by the Babylonians, which were a closely related people using the same language, the same type of writing, with a closely related culture. Now, those are three possibilities, as you see. And at this point, we cannot speak dogmatically on that. Personally, I incline very much to the third. Now, this word kingdom is a word that isn't much used today. 60 years ago, we would speak of the kingdom of Spain, the kingdom of Portugal, kingdom of Greece, the kingdom of Italy. We had many kingdoms in the world. Today, the word kingdom is little used. By the word kingdom, are we referring specifically to the rule of one man, or do we simply mean a nation, a national power, a strong power? Well, the word kingdom is used in this particular chapter in a way that it seems to me what it really means is not what we meant by kingdom even 100 years ago. That what it means is more like what we meant by empire then. And this word empire does never occurs in the Bible, but I think that it comes closer to representing what is meant by these kingdoms. Now, this word empire begins originally just meant a military commander. The Roman troops, after a great battle, would sometimes hail their commander as imperator, the commander par excellence, the man who gave the command. And from this word imperator, we derive our word emperor. And so it developed from the great power of the Roman rulers, and it has been carried on since that time, usually to mean someone who rules much more than one nation. Thus, the king of Germany during the Middle Ages would, if he had sufficient power, would go to Rome and be crowned as emperor by the Pope. And then he would call himself emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was supposed to embrace Germany and Italy and all the region in between. And if he was a very powerful man, he could come down several times and keep Italy under his control. Well, it was a difficult thing to do, and most of them didn't succeed very well in the task. But the word empire, the emperor, was considered a higher title than a king. Now, in modern times, I believe the word empire refers, like the term kingdom, not so much to a particular ruler as to a power. And when we speak of an empire, we are apt to mean that more than one nation is involved. That one nation exercises control over another nation, or that one man exercises control over several nations. And that, I think most interpreters would feel convinced, is what is meant by these various kingdoms here in Daniel. That is not kingdom in the sense we speak of the kingdom of Portugal, the kingdom of Spain, the kingdom of Greece, and the kingdom of Italy, but that it means an empire. That it means a power like Nebuchadnezzar had, where a group of different nations were all under his control and direction. And that it could be extended to that even if your rule was not a one-man rule, even if you had a senate or a group of leaders that controlled rather than an individual. Well, now, a third question here is there a progression in the metals? Now, it's verse 39 says, after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of bronze which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Well, this certainly gives a suggestion. The fourth kingdom is going to be the strongest of all. And so you would think that if there's a progression, it would be a progression in strength rather than weakness. And that would fit with the history, because Nebuchadnezzar ruled over an area you can see on this map here, which would extend about through here. It included, he conquered Jerusalem about halfway through his reign, once he made a campaign down into Egypt. But he held Palestine and Syria, he held Mesopotamia there. The Medes were not under his control over there, nor the Persians just south of the Medes. He didn't control Asia Minor. There was much area there that he did not control. The Persians that followed him, Cyrus the Persian first got control over all the Medes over there, and then he conquered Asia Minor over here. Then he came back and he conquered Babylon, got control of Nebuchadnezzar, took over the region Nebuchadnezzar had, and eventually his armies went clear to India and conquered a part of India. And so the empire that followed was three times as large in area as Nebuchadnezzar's, and at least twice as large in population. And then when Alexander the Great came from Greece, this area here had not been under the Persians at all. They conquered the whole Persian Empire, so their area was much larger. But the area of Rome and Europe here that the Romans had added still more territory to it. So that if you speak of area, these empires increase in size rather than diminishing in size. Now if you speak of population, they increase in size rather than diminishing in size. And so some have said, but there is a decrease. The second kingdom is inferior to you, and there's another third kingdom, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom, there must be a decrease. Now, if there's no decrease in area, if there's no decrease in population, the decrease must be that Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute despot, and then the next one gets weaker, and the next gets weaker, and the next gets weaker. And that idea has been advanced in recent years, but there's no basis for that. Because Nebuchadnezzar was not an absolute despot, even if it sounds so in the account of his relations with him in this chapter. Nebuchadnezzar was very much bound by the laws of Babylon. In fact, there has been found in Babylon a great monument put up in the central square of Babylon by King Hammurabi more than 1,000 years before Nebuchadnezzar, in which he shows a picture of the sun god giving him the laws at the top, and then tells below how the sun god gave him these laws and ordered him to put them up in the main square so that any citizen can come and read and know exactly what his rights are. Now today, if you want to know what your rights are, you pay $100 to a lawyer to try to find out. And another lawyer may differ from it. But in Babylon, the people had definite rights. Not near as much right as individuals have in this country. But they had definite rights. The power of the king, while very great, was not absolute. And in these various kingdoms, there was sometimes more autocracy, sometimes less. You cannot show a progression in that regard. And so I was puzzled by that, this statement. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. And so I asked the question, is this inferior a correct translation? And I looked at the Aramaic, and I found the Aramaic is the word arka, which is related to the Aramaic corresponding to the Hebrew word eris, which means earth. And it has an ending which means torn. The word occurs, I believe, only this place in the Aramaic of the Bible. Literally, it means toward the earth. And I had been told 30 years ago by the man who was then professor of Aramaic at the University of Chicago that he was making up a complete list of all the words in all the Aramaic inscriptions that had been found and all the Aramaic literature that has been preserved. And so I wrote to the present professor of Aramaic, and I asked him, I said, could you tell me from this list whether there is any other case you can call my attention to where this word means inferior? And he said, I know of no case where in the context the word means inferior. He said, as far as a list of all the Aramaic words is concerned, I don't know of any such thing here. So it may be the former professor took it with him when he retired. I don't know. But however, he said, it is perfectly obvious here in Daniel that it means inferior. Now, I don't think you can decide what a word means by saying it's perfectly obvious. The word means toward the earth. And the Persian kingdom was not inferior to the Babylonian kingdom. It was superior to it in very many regards. And if this simply means toward the earth, I think he is simply speaking of the place on the statue. You are the head of gold, and after you there will be another kingdom, which is lower down on the statue. And then he says there will be after it another kingdom of bronze. Now the kingdom, the third kingdom, wasn't specifically of bronze. In fact, they were using mostly iron weapons by that time. But it means it's represented by bronze on the statue. And so there is, to take it as meaning that there is a progression, that they are getting weaker in some regard, that these are, is reading into the scripture on the basis of a translation of one word and a translation which is not warranted. It's lower down on the statue. There are four kingdoms which actually increase in strength and in size rather than to decrease. Now, number four, the second, third, and fourth kingdoms, I have already mentioned the fact as to what they would seem to be. Because as your sheet I gave you out explains, Cyrus the Persian conquered the Medes. When he became king over the group of the Persians, they were subject to some extent to this loose confederation of the Medes. In fact, he married the daughter of the leading king of the Medes, but eventually he declared his independence of them, and then he fought them and overcame them and put them under his control and led them to conquer other nations around, and they came to the west, north of Babylon. And then they went up and they conquered the whole of Asia Minor. And after they had conquered all that territory, a territory much larger than the area that Nebuchadnezzar had, then he turned southward and went against Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And in 539, 23 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death, he conquered Babylon. And so we have this second kingdom, Cyrus the Persian. I've mentioned certain dates under him. 559 he became king. 546 he conquered Asia Minor. 539 he conquered Babylon, and 529 he died. Now we will have occasion to refer to those later. Don't worry if you didn't get that down now. There's quite a bit on this chart that relates to later chapters, not just to this chapter. But After him came the Hellenistic or Greek Empire, and then the Roman Republic and Empire. I want to mention the critical theory at this point. We have referred to it before. We are not in this course trying to prove the authenticity of Daniel. We accept it as part of the Bible, as part of that upon which our Lord Jesus Christ set his seal as being authentic and genuine. But as I mentioned last time, Porphyry in the 3rd century AD advanced the theory that the book of Daniel was not written in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but written in the time of the Hellenistic Empire, at a time of great crisis for the Jews. We'll look at this later on in connection with other chapters. But that at that time somebody wrote this and described past history as if it was a prediction. Well, now you notice the difficulty immediately that they have there, that the Hellenistic Empire is the third of these empires. And so the critics all say that the man who wrote the book of Daniel thought there was first the Babylonian Empire, then the Median Empire, then the Persian Empire, and now the Greek Empire in his own day. And actually, as we mentioned, Cyrus had the Medes entirely under his control and forming part of his army before he destroyed the Babylonian Empire. So the critics say that the writer was mistaken in his idea of the history, but that on most things he's so accurate that it must be that it was written later rather than early. Incidentally, you remember the phrase occurs in the book of Esther and also here, the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which combines the two as one power. And and in Daniel 6, where it tells, Daniel 5, where it tells of the destruction of the conquest of Babylon, it says your kingdom is given to the Medes and Persians. So to say that Daniel believed in a separate Median Empire is simply contrary to fact. Then there was a Median, a kingdom of the Medes, and then of the Persians, and then of the Greeks. But the Medes and the Persians are historically one empire. Now, the fifth part of the statute. And there I raise the question, are there four kingdoms or five? I don't think you could tell from the book of Daniel. He says, the fourth kingdom will be strong as iron. Then verse 41, whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Does he mean by that the next kingdom? Or the same thing. I don't think you could prove it from this chapter, but I think you'll find conclusive evidence about it when we get on a little further in the book of Daniel. But number two, the symbolic meaning of potter's clay, which of course means weak or brittle. Now we think of clay, we think of something like mud, something that just couldn't possibly stand up. Well, the statue couldn't possibly stand up if it just had some mud in the feet. It is quite obvious that what he means is potter's clay. In other words, it is clay which is dried in the sun or else baked in a furnace and therefore becomes what we now call china or pottery. It is something that can stand up by itself, and you could put a fair amount of weight on it, but nothing like the weight you could put on iron. And so it means that the feet have interspersed between them. They have this material which is brittle, which is easily broken, which is not strong like the iron in this fifth part. Now, number three, does the statement in verse 43 simply mean an unintegrated mixture of people? What is the character of this last part? The kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, and the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken, and whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Does that simply mean an unintegrated mixture of people, something like the present nation of Israel is, where you have a large part of the area with mostly Jews speaking Hebrew, and then you have another large section under their control of people who are mostly Arabs with a very different culture. Is that the sort of picture that is described here? Is it like Switzerland today, where you have about 60% speaking German and maybe 25% speaking French? And one day I walked from the German section just 5 miles across through the woods into the French section, and I couldn't find a person in the first town I came to that could even talk German. So distinct is the line, and yet they are one nation. Does this mean simply an unintegrated mixture of peoples, or does it mean something more than that? If that's all it means, it would fit the whole history of each of these empires. The Babylonians had various peoples mixed together. They transported people away from their homes to another section of the land and carried some of the people from that to another section. So they had these peoples mixed together and all having to look to the Babylonian king for protection from the other groups. Does it simply mean an unintegrated mixture of peoples? If so, it could fit the Babylonian Empire, it could fit the Persian Empire, which had so many different peoples in it that when Xerxes led a tremendous army to conquer Greece, they had maybe 40 different languages spoken by the soldiers, and it was very difficult to communicate and to organize them together. And the much smaller group of Greeks with extra good weather and various unusual circumstances were able to prevent them from conquering it. The Persian Empire could fit. Certainly the Hellenistic Empire had many different groups in it, not very well assimilated together, and certainly the Roman Empire did. So the possibility remains that verse 43 describes something that is not obvious. We will refer to this later on, but at the present, I simply give it as a problem. Exactly what does verse 43 here mean? Now, as we have noticed that in this chapter, we have a symbol given. We have the statue, then we have the three dynamic occurrences. The stone breaks away from the mountain without human hands. The stone hits the statue, utterly destroys it, and the stone grows till it becomes a whole nation. Now, all of that is symbolic. It is figurative. It is strictly figurative. But then when you get the interpretation is nearly all literal, plain language. You are this head of gold. The head of gold, in other words, stands for you. After you, there'll come another kingdom, further down on the statue, a kingdom which will rule over the whole earth, and then a third kingdom, and then a fourth kingdom. And this symbol meant this factor.